Welcome to our final presentation of Chapter 11, Fundamentals of Investing, with a concentration, with an emphasis on bonds, boring bonds, stodgy bonds, reliable bonds. Bonds represent loans. Yes, it's not a good word because people think of James Bond and they think of Barry Bonds. No. And they may think of savings bonds, which are similar but very different world. When you're a major corporation, a large company, you're a state or local government, a state or a city or a school district, or a bridge authority, or a water authority, or the federal government. You don't go to a bank when you need to lend, when you need to borrow money. No, you're big enough to sell bonds, to issue bonds to the investment community. And investors all around the world now can lend you money. And how do they do that? By buying your bonds. They buy your bonds, and you, as the government or the state and local municipality or the corporation, are then required to pay interest to the bond investors, to the bondholders. And then the principal is paid off, usually a longer term, 20, 30 years, although there are shorter term bonds. So as a bond investor, you're actually playing the part of the bank. You're lending your money to corporations, corporate bonds, to state and local governments, municipal bonds, or to the federal government, government bonds, or just called treasuries or governments. And do most people pay their loans? Yeah, normally, during normal times. And the same thing is true with bonds. Virtually all bonds are paid back now, every once in a while. Yeah, right. The bond issuer gets into trouble, normally a corporation, sometimes a municipality. The federal government has never not honored its debts. And, dear students, I don't care what anybody tells you, no matter what wing nut on the radio screaming down and hollering how the country is bankrupt, the federal government will pay its debts into the future. Bondholders are first in line for repayment if there's default on the loans. Now, that's not really true. The tax man has to get paid first, and if there are any payroll expenses, they need to be paid. But in general, bondholders are first in line when it comes to the capital structure, as it's often called, of the entity. Where are stockholders? Right, they're at the back. they're at the very end of the line, back of the bus, and they wind up usually with nothing. Usually the bondholders get something. Bonds are far less volatile than stocks, but they still fluctuate. Huh? I don't understand. Relax, folks. We'll discuss this in detail in a bit. The average return over decades has been, 4-5% for munis and treasuries, 6-7, almost 8%, kind of like a mortgage for corporations. But right now, they are paying far less than that. Interest rates are at generational lows, multi-decade lows, and so bonds are not returning that 4-5-6%. Bond investors just got used to 5-6% without any problem. Now, to get 5-6%, you have to take a very dangerous and distressed bond, a bond that's sometimes called junk, that we'll describe later on. Bonds are good intermediate term to long term investments, but there is a way for bonds to be short term, and we don't get into it in this class. But in the 123 class, Introduction to Investments, we discuss the reasoning and how to do that in detail. Slide 30. Why should investors buy bonds? Well, we already said that they're far less risky than stocks, and that's an important issue for many people. But in general, investors buy bonds for these first two attributes. You're going to get your money back, and you're going to get your interest. You know the interest rate. That's why bonds are often called fixed investments. You know how much money you're going to get in interest. By the way, bonds usually pay twice a year. Some bonds pay more often. And you know that you're going to get your money back. You're going to get the principal. However, there's always the risk of default. And as we said, the risk is normally very small. If the risk is high, the bonds are usually referred to as non-investment grade bonds. Well, most people call them junk bonds, distressed bonds, speculative bonds, right? These are companies that are normally companies, sometimes municipalities, sometimes state and local governments, not never states, but so far. Puerto Rico at times has been called junk, non-investment grade, and some cities, you might have heard of Stockton going through bankruptcy, Detroit went through bankruptcy, but normally, no, you don't have to worry about this. If you buy, you know, middle, we'll talk about credit quality, we'll talk about credit agencies later on. Now, the third reason you can buy your bond is because the bond value can go up. Huh? How can a loan go up in value? You may be able to sell the bond to someone else at a higher price if the interest rate on the bond is higher than the market rate. What? Hi? What are you talking? Later. Relax. Relax later. We said that bond prices do fluctuate. And how does that work? Well, it's a little tricky, and we'll discuss it. But some people buy bonds with the anticipation of making capital gains. It's not easy, folks. It's not easy. It is much more easy to buy bonds for interest income and for the principal to be repaid. 31. Why would an entity such as a state or local government or a corporation or a federal government, why would they sell bonds? Well, they need to borrow money, and this is how it works. You don't go to your local credit union to borrow $900 billion to invade Iraq, or you're just too big. So, entities such as corporations, municipalities, the federal government, and other governments around the world, they have to raise money, just as, you know, we have to raise money. We have to borrow sometimes to buy a home or whatever. Well, they have to do the same thing, except there's a whole lot more zeros. They need to build a new factory, expand in new countries, build new or upgrade older schools. You might have heard of Prop R at Southwestern Community College. And you know, you see that new stadium? We didn't have a bake sale to build that new stadium. We had to borrow millions of dollars to build that thing. And how did we do that? We sold bonds. We went to the to the voters of the South Bay, Southwestern Community College District, Sweetwater Union High School District. I'm sorry, I'm getting confused here. Southwestern went to the voters and said, "Hey, would you allow us to sell bonds to build up the campus? Because, you know, we're expanding, we're fixing up old things. We need, you know, $190 billion, And the voters said yes. The voters said yes. So now, how are those bonds being paid? How is the interest and the principal being paid? Well, there was a tax assessed on the property values here in the Southwestern Community College District in the South Bay. And so now the homeowners and the property owners are paying the interest and the principal. Yes, and almost every election year, dear students, in California, the voters are asked to approve a bond proposition for parks, schools, water projects, transportation, emergency, public safety equipment, prisons, you name it, the bullet train. And if the voters say yes, the state of California then sells the bonds to pay for the project and must pay the interest and pay back the principal over typically 30 years. So do you believe that most people who are voting for these propositions. Do you think they really understand what they are doing when they vote for these things? I don't think so. I mean, most people don't have an idea. They want the parks, and they want the the schools, and the bullet train, and new freeways and emergency equipment. But they don't understand that we're going to have to pay for this. You know, it doesn't. You don't just wave a magic wand and poof, it appears. It costs money. So do now, when you see those ballot propositions, those bond propositions, do look at them carefully, because you're putting the taxpayers, you and I, on the hook for 30 years to pay back these things. And the bond rates are normally a whole lot better than you would get at a bank. If you were big enough to sell bonds, you could do a better job of pay fewer dollars in interest. But you and I are not big enough to sell bonds. You have to be a pretty big entity. By the way, interesting, real side note, sorry to digress, but you remember David Bowie? He wasn't the only one who did it. I think the group REM, yeah. He went to the investment community and said, hey, you know, I'm David Bowie, and I'm making a lot of money with my touring and my music, and I act and movies and the like. Will you lend me money through a bond issue? It was a small amount compared to, you know, normal bonds, which are, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and into billions of dollars. I think it was $55 million. And the investment community said, sure. It was a higher rate than municipal bonds and government bonds, because he's a guy, he's an entertainer, and all the bonds were paid back. So if you and I were as popular as David Bowie, we could do that. I don't know that I would want to, but I guess he had some plans for that money. I'm not sure exactly what he did with it, but every dime was paid back. Mm-hmm. Slide 32. In the case where the bond issuer is a corporation, sometimes it is difficult, not advantageous, or impossible to sell stock. So if you're a corporation, you'd like to be able to sell your own stock, because you don't have to pay that back, as we'll see when we get to next chapter. If you're a corporation, you have to pay the bond issue back, but you might not be able to sell stock. Or it might be useful to you, because the tax deductible expense of the interest is going to save you money on your taxes, the corporation, that is. Whereas if you pay stockholders dividends, that's not tax deductible, and we'll discuss that when we get to stocks. And we'll talk about financial leverage, using other people's money to make your money, when we get to real estate. Because that is one tool in the business persons, in the corporations, or real estate investors' arsenal that can be very advantageous, but it can also come back to bite you, because now you owe them the money. Let's read together at the bottom. Bonds are debt financing. Corporations, municipalities, or the federal government borrow for many of the same reasons that individuals borrow for, to finance their operations. Whereas stocks are equity financing. What does that mean? The corporation is selling a piece of itself to finance the operations of the company. You see, governments can't do that. The city of Chula Vista can't sell a piece of the city. It's a sovereign entity. Now, they can sell the land if they own it, or any assets that they own. But no, they don't sell. You can't own a piece of the city of Chula Vista, or the state of California, or the United States of America. So that's only corporations that can sell stock. So slide 33. What are some of the characteristics of bonds? Well, a bond is, you can think of it like a mortgage. There are written documents. Well, I guess it's all electronic now, but it's called the bond indenture. It's the loan agreement. And there are trustees that watch over the entity to make sure that they do what they say they're going to do, pay back the bond, and if they say they're going to buy this, sell these bonds and take this money and build a new factory, then the trustees make sure it happens. For example, Proposition R. We said we're going to use that money to fix up the campus, to build new buildings, and we are. We can't use it to give ourselves a raise or to have a party or whatever. I mean, the trustees are looking over our shoulders and making sure we do what we say we're going to do. And every bond has a par value, a face value. Now, normally it's $1,000. Sometimes it's $5,000, sometimes it's $10,000. But for our class, for our practical purposes, it will always be $1,000. So when you see face value, par value, just know it's $1,000. Realizing it's a few others that are $5,000 and $10,000, we won't deal with that. Everything is $1,000. And bondholders receive interest every 6 months in the United States. Some other countries, it's once a year, and sometimes it's every month. Not many pay that. Most bonds pay every 6 months. Okay? So there are some of the characteristics of bonds. And if you don't remember that, you will when you take Business 123, because I'm going to drum it into your head. Slide 34. What are some of the types of bonds? Well, the two types are the ones I want you to worry about here. The secured and unsecured. Wait a minute. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Do you remember when we were talking about credit? There's secured credit that was backed by your home or your car. And then there was unsecured credit that was only backed by the full faith and credit of you paying them back, your credit cards, right? And the same thing is true, except there's a lot more zeros here. A mortgage-backed bond, or sometimes called an asset-backed bond, is secured by the various assets of the issuing firm. So they say, you know, we're going to sell these bonds based on this water plant or this factory we're building. Well, the bond is backed by that, so if they don't pay the bond back, then the bond investors... But the trustee does it on their behalf, then take over the assets. Whereas debentures, I've heard it said both times, and I'm not sure which one is right, are unsecured bonds. And they are backed just like a credit card by the reputation of the issuer. If the bond issuer does not pay, then bond investors have to go after whatever assets or income that they can find. So you see, it's... Everything works the same, but it's just it's the same idea. I'm sorry, it doesn't work the same. It's the same idea, it's just on a bigger scale, a whole lot more zeros. Now, I throw this last guy in. I don't know why I shouldn't. I should take it out, but it's just so sexy to hear about convertible bonds, right? You like a convertible car, you take the top down and drive on the freeway and the wind is blowing through your hair. And you think it's so cool until you have to actually live with the darn thing and it's raining and you can't get the top back up. Or somebody is a rag and somebody accidentally pokes a hole through it. Well, the same thing is true with convertible bonds. They sound sexy, but in reality, they're really not worth it. In my humble opinion, there are other people who say, no, you don't understand, I've done well with these. They can be exchanged at the owner's option for a specified number of common stock. So you can take your bond and give it to the company and they'll give you back stock. And sometimes it works out, usually no. But I just throw it in there because it's an interesting little oddity that you may pique your interest. If not, I apologize. Slide 35. What is the call feature of bonds? Well, corporations and municipalities can sometimes call in, buy back outstanding bonds. Here, bonds! Come here, bonds! From the current bondholders. Sound familiar? Remember we talked about refinancing a loan? It's the same idea. Now, corporate bonds and muni bonds often are callable. Some are non-callable. So far, the Treasury, the United States, has never issued callable bonds. And most have some kind of deferred call period, call protection period. Look, we're not going to call it in for 5-10 years, okay? Relax, we're not going to do it. You buy the bonds and all of a sudden we call them back in. No, that's not going to happen. Bonds are called in if the interest rate they are paying is higher than the going rate. So if interest rates have fallen, the bond issuers, the states, the state and local governments, the corporations, not the federal government so far, will say, hey, we can get a better interest rate. Let's call in the bonds and reissue new bonds. Now, it costs money to do that, just as it costs money for a homeowner to refinance their home loan, but it's the same idea. Cool? I think so. Taxes. Slide number 36. Why are you always talking about taxes? Well, you know what? Taxes are very important, and we find that when you buy a corporate bond, it is taxed at your marginal tax rate, just as if you had earned income through your job. However, there's a very interesting part to this. Municipal bonds are not subject to federal income taxes, and federal bonds are not subject to state income taxes. Why? Because of the Constitution. The Constitution says that the feds can't tax the states and local governments, and the state and local governments can't tax the feds. So this is a very important feature for wealthy investors. For working grunts like you and me, it's usually not that big a deal. It can be useful. But once you're up in the 39.6, once you get up there, these things become very, very attractive. And some muni bonds are double tax-free. What does that mean? Well, your state will say, look, you invest in us, in our case, California, you buy our bonds, we will not, you're already exempt from federal income taxes, but we will not charge you state income taxes because you're a resident of California and you're buying California bonds. Doesn't matter where in the state. You don't have to buy them locally. So that's a very cool feature. And, of course, it depends on what state you're in, because some states have very low income taxes. If you're in a high-income tax state, such as California, then it can be a very useful feature. Now, you have to be careful. Remember the dreaded AMT, alternative minimum tax? Some municipal bonds are no longer exempt from federal taxes because the IRS made this interpretation and the courts backed them up and said, well, that's not really a municipal bond. You tried to hide a private enterprise behind a municipal bond and we're going to tax you. And the courts backed them up. But once you start making $150,000, $200,000 a year and you start getting attacked by the AMT, you'll need to educate yourself or find a good investment advisor who can explain the advantages of a non-AMT municipal bond. Slide 37. Now there's a worksheet in Chapter 11 that we, in the face-to-face class, we would do it together, so you can do it on your own now, or you can wait until after the presentation. But the formulas look very similar to something we've seen before. Do you remember the after-tax cost of items? Right. Well, this is the same formula, but it's the taxable equivalent yield. It's the after-tax yield, if you will. And how do we calculate that? We take the tax-exempt yield of the municipal bond, and we divide that by 1 minus your federal marginal income tax rate. Does that look familiar? It should. Right. So if we're getting 6% from a muni bond, which is not typical these days, folks, but let's say we are, and we're in the 25% tax bracket, what is it really paying us? Well, we take that tax-exempt yield. Oh, by the way, the IRS doesn't like the word tax-free. I like to use the tax-free, but they like tax-exempt. Okay, 6%, 0.06, divided by 1.0, that's 100%, by the way, minus 25%, 0.25. And if you work that out, you wind up with 0.08. Now, what does that mean? It means that you have to go out, if you're in the 25% tax bracket, and find a corporate bond paying 8% to be equivalent to your 6% muni bond. Now, you might, relax. You might be getting a little nervous, but it's very simple. write down $1,000 because that's the normal par value of a bond. And then multiply that times 6%. What do you get? $60. That's why they use $1,000. It makes it very easy. You know you're going to get $60. Write down $1,000 and then multiply it times 8%. You get $80. So you're telling me, Payano, that I would rather have the 6% muni bond instead of the 8% corporate bond? No, I'm not telling you which one you'd rather have, but I'm saying they are equivalent. How can $80 be equivalent to $60? That $80 is taxable. Multiply that $80 times 25%, and you're paying $20 to the federal government in the form of taxes. And how much is left over after you've paid the $20? $60. So it sounds really tricky and sneaky and every way. I know it's very simple. If I don't have to pay taxes, that bond is worth more to me if it's the same interest rate. So I have to do a calculation to make them apples to apples. I can't just look at 6% and 8% yield and say, I don't know which one's better. 8% could be better, but the 6% could be better depending on my tax bracket. And as your tax bracket goes higher, the taxable equivalent yield actually gets less. So we find that these muni bonds are very popular with wealthy people. In fact, this is not a face-to-face class, but in a face-to-face class, after we've done a few calculations and gone through all these slides, we then show you some municipal bond quotes. And what you will invariably see is $25,000 minimum. In other words, these are targeted towards the very wealthy. Okay, now slide 38. What happens if it's a California bond for us, for those of us who live in California? If it's a double tax exempt, double tax free bond, well, then we have to include the state income tax. So here we take the tax exempt yield before we've done the calculation, and divided by 1 minus the federal and the state. So let's say we're in the 25% federal bracket, as we were before, and the 8% state bracket. We then take the 6% divided by 1 minus the combined federal and state, that's 33%. Go ahead, do it, calculate it. And it turns out that 6% California bond, if we're California residents, if you're listening from out of California, then you have to insert your state there. That is worth to us 8.95%. Pretty cool. Right, because we're not paying federal income taxes at 25%, and we're not paying state income taxes at 8%. And check out different numbers. Bump it up to 35% and 10%. Or bring it down to 15% and 2%. And you'll see that, yes, the wealthier you are, the more income you're generating, the better deal these municipal bonds are for you. That's why they're typically bought by high income, high net worth individuals. Slide 39. How do I make a decision to buy or sell a bond? Well, how do they make a decision about whether they should lend money to you? The credit card companies, they check your credit score. And that's exactly what we do with bonds. But it's not called the credit score, it's called the bond rating. The bond rating starts at AAA and then goes to AAA, BBB, BBB, CCC, CCC, and then ends at D, which many people just say default. And there's a few agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, Weiss, and they all work basically the same way. I think Moody's uses, AAA, and then they use BAA, they don't go BBB, but it's the same idea. It reminds me of eggs. What's the difference between a double A and a egg? I don't know, but And the same thing is true with these. You look at, well, why did this one bond get a double A and why did this one bond get an A? They have their own reasons, but I never trust these people. I think of them as idiot lights on the car's dashboard. Now, I'm not a motorhead. I don't know cars that well, but it used to be that when the red light for your engine came on, what did you do? Just keep driving. You only got a couple miles before the engine seizes up. Not anymore. My understanding is not anymore. If you see the red light, pull over immediately. Maybe you can fix it. I don't know. I don't trust them. And the same thing is true here. And they've shown that sometimes they make monumental mistakes. They were caught completely flat-footed in the 2008 debacle, the home housing crisis. They had rated these bonds that were based on all the liar loans, all the no-doc option arms. They had rated them triple A, figuring the housing prices would never go down. Right. Anything below BBB is called non-investment grade. Remember we talked about those? If the bond's in distress, if it's a junk bond, if it's a speculative bond, distressed bond, that means you're taking a lot of risk to get your interest. And you're going to get a higher interest rate because, of course, it's a lower rated bond. And the same thing is true when you want to borrow money. If your credit score is in the porcelain oasis, most people don't want to lend to you, and the people who do want to lend to you want to charge you an outrageous amount of money because they're worried about you paying them back. Make sense? Okay, good. Slide number 40. All right, okay, we're going to spend, I know it's a little tricky, it drives people crazy, but it's really not that hard. If you think of the seesaw, see the little picture? It's supposed to be a seesaw. My apologies if it doesn't look like one. But bonds, prices, and interest rates have an inverse relationship. As interest rates fall, bond prices rise. As interest rates rise, bond prices fall. Now, why is this? Well, the interest rate on your bond is fixed. It cannot change. If it's a 7% bond, it will always be a 7% bond. If it's a 4% bond, it will always be a 4% bond. And since the interest rate of your bond does not change, the price of the bond changes to reflect the change in interest rates within the financial industry because the price of your bond is not fixed. It starts out at $1,000, but if interest rates fall, now your bond will be worth more. It'll go up in value. And if interest rates rise, now your bond will be worth less. It'll go down in value. And I know it's a little tricky to think about that, but it's how it works, folks. And it is a great source of confusion and consternation, I like that word, consternation, to many in and out of the investment world. It drives a lot of people nuts, even people who work with these things all the time. Slide 41. So let's see how this works. Let's say your bond is paying 10%, which is, not these days. That was back in the 1980s, you had to see 10%. The bond's face value is 1,000. It will always be 1,000. The face value does not change. So you're going to get $100 every year. Well, actually, $50 twice a year because they pay you two times a year, but that's a side note. So you understand? $1,000 bond, always $1,000. 10%, you get $100. Now, what happens if interest rates fall to 5%? Now, a new bond is only going to pay $50. Investors have to buy two bonds to get the same amount of interest that your one bond is paying. So, would you sell your bond for $1,000 to somebody else when you know that new bonds are only given half of what your bond is paying? No, you're not going to. You're going to demand a premium. Now, are you going to get $2,000? No, you're not going to get $2,000. Why? Because when the bond is paid back, when the bond matures, when the bond is redeemed, how much are you going to get? Only $1,000. So your bond price wouldn't double, but it would go very high, according to certain measurements that we learn about in the Business 123 class. It has to do with how long the bond has until it matures. Make sense? Yes, indeed, it does. What happens now when the inverse happens? You buy a bond at 5%, and you're getting $50 of interest, $25 twice a year, and now interest rates rise to 10%. Uh-oh. New bonds are paying $100. Is anybody going to buy your raggy old bond paying $50 for $1,000? No. If you wanted to sell it, and you don't have to, by the way. No one's forcing you to sell your bond. But if you wanted to sell it, you would have a capital loss. You would have to sell it at a large discount. I mean, if interest rates doubled, yes, you would wind up selling your bond at a large discount. But if you hang on to the bond, you're going to get your $1,000 back. So you don't have to do that. Now, if this is totally confusing, stop. Go back a few slides and do it again. Because in reality, folks, if you simply think of the seesaw, interest rates go down, bond prices go up. Interest rates go up, bond prices go down. You will find that it's actually pretty easy to follow. If you don't think of the seesaw, you better be a whole lot smarter than I am, because that's how I keep from making mistakes. Slide 43. So now in the face-to-face class, we would spend some time on these checking for comprehension. And if you printed it out, obviously you already see the answer. But once upon a time, bought a corporate bond paying 8% 4 years ago. Today, corporate bonds that are like Juan's bond are paying 6%. Would Juan be able to sell his bond for more than he paid for it, less than he paid for it, or the same amount that he paid for it? He could sell for more. Right. What has happened? Interest rates have fallen. The bond price goes up. The bond could be sold at a premium. You don't have to sell it. You can hang on to it. But if you were going to sell it, people would say, hey, I'll pay you more than $1,000 for it. What about slide 44? El Coco. Luis Coco. El Coco. The Anglos go, huh? That's the boogeyman in Mexico. Bought a treasury bond paying 5% 2 years ago. Today, treasury bonds are paying 7%. Interest rates have gone up. So would Señor Coco be able to sell his bond for more, less, or the same amount? Interest rates go up. Bond prices go down. If he were to sell now, he would have to sell it at a discount, because people would say, oh, I'm not paying you $1,000. I can get a bond that's paying me $70 for $1,000. I want you to sell it for less. How much less? We'll learn about in 123. Slide 45. So, here's a lot of information on this slide. Write this down. It's in the book. The relationship of bonds and interest rates is why a bond will have different quoted rates. All right? The nominal rate, the coupon rate, is the rate that the bond pays on the original amount of the loan. That never changes. That is fixed. Nominal means named, right? Exactly. And coupon, where does coupon come from? Well, it's still in the language, but it means that it comes back to a time when bonds were these documents that literally had coupons attached to them. Huh? That is how you got paid. You would clip the coupon, write your name and address, send it into the company or the entity, the state and local government, and the federal government, and they would send you back a check. Now, why did they do this? Well, it actually made it very easy for you to turn around and sell your bond, because all you did was sell the document with all the coupons attached to it to somebody else, and then they would clip them and send it in. And to this day, earning interest on a bond is still called clipping the coupons. Little bit of history for you. Do they have these things anymore? No, it's all electronic. So the nominal rate is very simple. It's either 7% or 6% or 5%. It does not change. It's the coupon rate. Nominal rate stays the same. Now, what about the current yield? Well, this is the true rate of interest that the bond buyer is getting currently, since it reflects the premium or discount price that the buyer had to pay. Because if you have to pay a premium, you're not getting the same interest rate as the nominal rate. You're getting something less. And if you pay a discount, you're getting something more. And we're going to see this when we do some calculations. The yield to maturity goes one step further. That takes into account holding on to the bond until it matures. The current yield is just what you're getting today. But every day it changes because you're getting closer and closer to the day that bond matures. And the price gets closer and closer and closer to the par value. If the nominal rate, the current yield, the yield to maturity are all the same, that means the bond is selling at par. It's selling at $1,000. There's no premium, there's no discount. And so all three are the same. But that rarely happens, folks. Once the bond is out there for any length of time, interest rates are changing, and so the bond price is changing. Let's take a look at the first calculation. Again, this is on the worksheet, and we would do this together. We would look at the example, and then in the face-to-face class, we'd do it together. So the worksheet's out there. You need to work on these. You take the dollar amount of the annual interest, and remember, that's very simple. If it's a 6% bond, $60. If it's an 8% bond, $80. If it's a 4% bond, $40. It's that simple. So if we have a 6% bond, we're getting $60. But let's say the bond is selling for $1,100. Right. The interest rates have fallen. Bond prices have risen. Now we have to pay $1,100. So that means 60 divided by 1,100 is 5.45%. A bond selling at a premium has a current yield lower than its stated nominal rate. Does that make sense? Do the calculation yourself. Use your calculator, and you'll see that that's true. Why? Because you're not getting it for $1,000. If you were paying $1,000, you'd get $60. You'd get 6%, because $60 is 6% of $1,000. But you have to pay more than $1,000. You have to pay $1,100. So you really only getting 5.45% on your money. Now, what happens when the bond is selling at a discount? That's when I like to buy them, right? You're still getting $6. That is fixed. That doesn't change. $60. Did I say $6? You're still getting $60. That doesn't change. 6% of $1,000. But now you only had to pay $900. Cool. Now I get 6.67% on my money. A bond selling at a discount has a current yield higher than its stated nominal rate. Make sense? Okay. Now, yield to maturity. Slide 48. It's scary. It's horrible. No, it's really actually very simple. You just plug in the numbers and do the calculations. The yield to maturity takes into account the fact that when you redeem the bond, you're going to only get $1,000 back. So maybe you paid $1,100 for it, or maybe you paid $900 for it. When you redeem the bond, you're going to get $1,000. So it's really the same formula as the current interest, the current rate, except we've added a few terms to take into account the fact that as it gets closer and closer and closer to the maturity, the bond price is going to get closer and closer and closer and eventually be $1,000. So let's work this out together. It's the same bond, 6%, selling at $900, selling at a discount, but now we know that it's 10 years of maturity. So here's the annual interest rate. See, that's the same. The annual interest rate, $60. Don't put 6 cents, okay? Some people put 6 cents. No, you get a sapapo if you do that. 6 cents is if the bond were selling at a dollar. It's not selling at a dollar. It's selling at $1,000. So you get $60, And now let's do the bottom, because that's a little easier than the top right half part. Let's do the bottom first. What is this? The face value plus the market value divided by 2. Well, I know what that is. That's just averaging, right? If you take two numbers, add them together, and divide by 2, you get the average. So if the face value, the par value, is 1,000, it will always be 1,000. And the market value is 900. Well, then you add those two together, you get 1,900. Divided by 2, you get 950. The midpoint between 1,000 and 900. I think that's pretty straightforward. Here's the scary one, right? Here's the scary one. What is that doing? Well, let's go through it first, and then we'll see. 1,000, the face value, minus the market value. Notice it's a minus up here and a plus down here. But don't confuse those two. 1,000 minus 900 is $100. Divided by 10 years is $10. And so what is that saying? It's saying, look, today you're paying $900 for this. But in 10 years, you're going to get $1,000. So every year, the price of the bond is going to go up by $10 because it's getting closer and closer to the day that the bond is redeemed at $1,000. So you're really getting an extra $10 a year. You understand? It's, you know, it's scary when you look at it, but when you piece it apart, you go, oh, this makes perfect sense. Every year, I bought it at $900, and in 10 years, it's going to be worth $1,000. So that means every year I'm getting an extra $10 from my bond. Cool. And it turns out that this bond is paying us, if we hold it to maturity, about 7.4%. And then, of course, you're going to do the one in the worksheet and the assignment and the money on the task. So don't blow these off, please, folks. They're not that hard. That's the thing that amazes me, is people just close their eyes and they won't even try. And sure, you might be math phobic, you might not enjoy it, but if you do it enough times, you'll find that I can do this. And one of the best things about this is it shows you that the people on Wall Street, the people in the three-piece suits and the Rolex watches, they're not any smarter than you and I are. You know, they figured this out. They banged away at it. And some of them can't even do it very well. They just look it up. Slide 49. Where do you buy bonds? Well, the primary bond market, when they're sold for the very first time, is via an investment bank. We talked about, oh no, we didn't. We will talk about Goldman Sachs in the next chapter. You know, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley, or the company directly. And most of us do not get involved in the primary bond market when they're first sold, unless you go to treasurydirect.gov. You see, when you buy a corporate bond or a muni bond, you really have to have a whole lot of money and have a private relationship with a broker and all this other stuff going on. But the Treasury said, no. We want everybody to be able to buy our bonds. So anybody can open up an account at treasurydirect.gov, and you get the same price that the people with the millions and billions of dollars get who are on Wall Street. Very cool. But once the bond has been sold, then you have to buy it through the secondary market, which means you go to through a broker or another investor who wants to sell it. You pay a commission. And as we already said, very few small investors, in terms of money, not their size, participate in the bond markets. Bond traders normally deal in the millions of dollars. They want you to have at least $25,000, preferably $100,000 or more. But the major exception is TreasuryDirect.gov, where the small investor with $1,000 is welcome at TreasuryDirect.gov. Very cool. In fact, the Mexican government modeled their system after ours. I met the guy who was in charge of the project, and he said he was very frank about it, very candid. I'm frank. He said, yeah, we basically copied yours. We thought it was such a good deal for such a great program, and we did the same thing that you did, and it's been very successful. So cool. Slide number 50. Well, Payano, you just got done telling me that you got to have $25,000, $100,000 to invest in bonds. So, you know, how am I going to invest in bonds? Well, as we said in Chapter 11, you aren't. You're going to invest in mutual funds that invest in bonds, financial intermediary. And why? Well, because you get professional money management. They go out, knock on the doors, and the, you know, the companies, check out the municipalities, do all the numbers, and they decide which bonds are good to buy, and then you get instant diversification. You don't buy one or two or ten bonds. You buy 150 or 250. And as we said, the smallest transactions are normally in the tens of thousands of dollars. The mutual fund managers, they have millions of dollars. Some have billions of dollars, and they get a better deal because of their size. Although, as we said, if you are so inclined, you can buy treasury bonds $1,000 at a time directly from the federal government. So, the bottom line on bonds. They're good intermediate-term investments. They are decent long-term investments. And they're especially good for those who have trouble sleeping at night if they were fully invested in stocks. Do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well? But don't be fooled. Bonds have significant risks too. Interest rate risk. Remember we talked about that? Especially when interest rates are very low, like right now. And for years now, people have been saying, oh, the interest rates have got to go up. The interest rates have got to go up. They keep going down. Someday they're going to go up. Please, Lord. That means the economy is getting stronger when interest rates go up and people, you know, the demand for money is getting stronger, and that means businesses are doing well. And we want interest rates to go up eventually, but when they do, some bond investors are going to be a little taken aback because, you know, they were told that bonds are far less risky than stocks, and somehow they believe that they'll never go down. No, they will go down, but that's a good sign. That's a good sign. It's a good sign that the economy as a whole is getting stronger. And, of course, if you're a bond investor, I hope you also have some stocks, if you have a long-term time horizon. And that will smooth out the ride, because if bonds go down, that usually means, not always, that the economy is doing better and stocks will do well. So think about them, folks. The bottom line for me for bonds is that for younger folks, I don't think you should own any. We'll talk about asset allocation in Chapter 12 and a little bit in Chapter 13, but if you're young, stay away from bonds. When you get into your 50s and 60s, that's when you need to start being serious about bonds. But there are always exceptions, and some people just might be too terrified that they're going to lose $50 or $100, and so they don't want any money in the stock market. Fine, fine, fine. Buy bonds. Now, our next chapter, dear students, we discuss the sexy, the exciting, the risky stock investments. See ya!